Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Basic Folk, a podcast where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I am Lizzie No, I'm your host today, and I am so privileged to be hosting a roundtable discussion with three other artists that I just have infinite admiration for: Jake Blount, Kaya Cater, and Allison Russell. Thank you all so much for being here today.
It's a joy to be here with you all.
I wanted to start by setting the table a little bit for why we're here, why we're doing this special episode of Basic Folk, and also to let our listeners know what we're not here to do. So a few weeks ago, a really hateful article was published in Pace Magazine, kind of lumping a lot of really diverse Black artists together, leveling some unfair critiques at a lot of us as a group. And I want to encourage our listeners to not click on the article, because not only is it hurtful, there are so many holes in its logic that it's hard to read. I will encourage people to read Jake's really thoughtful, accurate, funny, succinct rebuttal. Basically, what those two articles did was spark a conversation about the state of Black musicians in roots music today, and that's what I want to talk about. I don't want to talk about the haterism. I want to talk about like what's on our minds. So I want to start with a quote from Toni Morrison. "The function, the very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being. Somebody says you have no language and you spend 20 years proving that you do. Somebody says your head isn't shaped properly, so you have scientists working on the fact that it is. Somebody says you have no art, so you dredge that up. Somebody says you have no kingdoms, so you dredge that up. None of this is necessary. There will always be one more thing." So let's just set aside the possibility of like having to assert that Black artists belong in roots music, because we all know that we belong. Our work speaks for itself. Our many contributions speak for themselves. Let's talk about like the state of the union of Black artists right now. Folk and roots music have always had Black art at its center, but it can also be a tricky place for Black artists to thrive. My theory is that like while the community can tend to be more politically liberal than like mainstream country, we also have a focus on tradition and the past, which can make us really like, let's face it, snobby and stubborn in folk music. So I want to put this question to all of you, maybe starting with Jake. Like, why do you think that this is a really tricky moment for Black artists in roots music? Why do you think these conversations are getting more and more heated right now?
Well, I think it's just that people are starting to gain recognition and success in a way that maybe has been deserved for a while but hasn't been there. I mean, the funny thing for me about reading that article was that he seemed to be so suddenly upset over these artists who have been on the scene for like decades. Like, Allison has been out here making really good music for a really long time, and they're all acting like she just showed up. Like, it's a little bit confusing. And I think he clearly was reacting to the Newport lineup, which I was also a part of, and feeling like maybe too many spots were set aside or whatever it may be. I just think that it's the sudden groundswell of Black artists that is freaking people out who were maybe okay with one or two. Like, Tracy Chapman was fine, but just Tracy Chapman, right? Like, nobody else gets in. And I think they're just going to have to start dealing with it.
Absolutely. I love what you said, Jake, because that is something that I have been privately chuckling about, is this notion of after 22 years of being a professional musician, being kind of noticed as emerging and, it makes me laugh and it's fine. It's like I'm a cicada, like scrabbling up through the soil for 20 years. But it's, you're absolutely right, Jake. It's the fact that so many more artists are being recognized by gatekeepers who in the past did not include us. And that is, you know, that's at the heart of it, is who is the gatekeeper? Who is the curator? And to me, that's the most problematic thing about, I don't care what, you know, there are plenty of cisgender, heterosexual, white men of a certain age who are going to despise what I do. And I'm fine with that. You know, we're going to despise what any of us
God
does.
Bless.
And
God
I'm
bless.
Fine with that. Goodbye. That's fine. They can and they can think what they want. They can write what they want. That's fine. It's freedom. Great. What to me was problematic is that two editors at Paste signed off on that article. You know,
right.
The title alone should have been a massive red flag, you know? So that's where I'm interested in pushing for change there on the gatekeeping side. I feel like all of us artists have been here. We are here. We are, as mm-hmm. as our sweet friend Brandi Carlile would say, the architects of Americana. You know, the contributions of the Black diaspora are at the heart of every idiom and genre of American song. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just no, you can't, as you say, Lizzie, we don't have to prove it. We don't have to reprove it. It's just a fact. You know, but what is important, I think, right now is the other side of the curtain is really important. You know, who is in those curatorial positions? And that was part of mm-hmm. what happened at Newport and why maybe there was that kind of reaction to it is that some of the curation was put into my hands for that festival. Mm-hmm. And that was unprecedented. That has never happened in the history of Newport. And I give kudos, you know, to Jay Sweet for recognizing, oh, there's, you know, I see what I see from my perspective. Maybe I need to open this up a little bit, you know, and I'm very proud of him for doing that. It's not easy to have that kind of self-reflection and self-criticism in a sense of saying, oh, wait, maybe there's something I'm not seeing. You know, maybe someone else needs to make some of these decisions too. And I think that is what I hope comes out of this for Paste is that they see that they've got a little bit of an issue in terms of who are their editors, who are the people that they are giving a regular platform to, you know, who gets mm-hmm. the recurring columns, who gets to write about Black artists in Americana right now. Is it really appropriate that they chose to have, you know, a cisgender, heterosexual, white male of a certain age be the voice of that, you know?
Yeah,
I have my opinion. Yeah. Hell no, that was super inappropriate, you know. But like,
I would add, yeah. I did get to talk to them about it. When I published my response article to it, mm-hmm. they were very much like, if you have any questions for us about how this happened, please ask them. We are very embarrassed about it. They explained it. It was a bad mistake, and a damaging one. I think that they have realized that, and my hope is that, you know, moving forward, they will act with more caution. It definitely, that was also one of my first thoughts, was like, how did someone come up to them being like, hey, I, a white man, would like to publish an article on why Black people aren't good at stuff? And they were like, great, that sounds like a plan.
We love it. Here's our platform. I think this is like this is something that I'm always kind of on a soapbox yelling about, that there is a lot of behind the scenes work that happens in the music industry that people aren't aware of. And like, why should they? You know, if you're not you're not in this industry, you might not know that for every artist that you see having an album release, there are dozens and dozens of people behind the scenes who made that happen. And so even if you're seeing, let's say, a female artist in country or a Black artist in roots, that's not necessarily telling the whole story, right? Because who is managing that person? Who were the people at the label that got to make the decision whether or not they got a budget? Like, let's be real. Like, who's getting to decide who's getting an album budget? Who's programming the festivals? Who are the agents that are deciding, you know, who's going to go on which lineup, et cetera, et cetera? So I think there's this illusion that there is a huge explosion of Black power in Roots. I actually think it's just surface level at this point. And this argument that, like, oh, Black people are getting, you know, too much appreciation and too much leeway is based on a misunderstanding of the industry. Like, yes, there are more visible artists right now. Yes, critics are loving the art being made, particularly by Black women artists right now. But, like, behind the scenes, it's still the same people making the decisions. And I think that's what we're trying to push to change.
Yeah, I think, like, it reminds me of that saying, like, nothing about us without us. Yes. And so many of those rooms are still, like, so white. And I think things get said in there and decisions get made in there that, like, that sort of trickle down to us as performers. You know, like, I wonder if any of you have been put on the all-Black woman workshop. You know, yeah, where it's like, so what do you have times in common? You're all Black women. Great. You know, and it's like so clear. Like, if it was like a good programming decision, you could tell. But I think you sort of get a sixth sense about what feels, like you said, Lizzie, like just totally performative and ill thought out. You know, and like, of mm-hmm. course, that workshop's going to be banging because I think like we're all great and I love us. But mm-hmm. but so many of those rooms and especially as Allison was saying, like those editorial rooms, you know, they're just so white. And I think they want to keep it that way because like I wonder if they really want to be challenged and if they really want that voice of dissent in the room, right, saying, no, you can't write about this artist this way. This is racist, or, yes, you know, this is sexist, or this is, you know, homophobic or transphobic, or, like, I think they really don't want to hear that. But the problem is
they want to put us in a room with each other.
Yeah.
You know, where we can talk amongst ourselves and not challenge the status quo.
I think there's such deep fetishism and tokenism that we're pushing back against. And it's going to take time because this is a construct that was built for a reason, you know, and it was built to consolidate power for a tiny white minority. That's the truth, you know, and patriarchal, obviously, mostly male. It was built to serve a tiny cadre of white men. You know, racism is a false construct in order to do that. Sexism is a false construct in order to do that. Every harmful ism. And it's going to take time and intention and coalition. I mean, this is the word I come back to over and over and over again.
Coalition.
Coalition. Because the only way any of that works is through a divide and conquer strategy that has been unchallenged, really, since I talk about this a lot in my band. We all have been reading Adrian Brown's Emergent Strategies, and it's so brilliant. But we've been talking about that we've trapped in this feudalist system and mentality, hierarchical mentality of there's a tiny deserving percentage at the top, and then the rest of us are all some level of less deserving, you know? And it's nonsense, and it only works when we buy into any part of that divide and conquer competition versus community mentality, you know? And it's and everything is set up to try and pit us against each other. And that's, but it's a trick, and it's a bad trick, and it's tired. It is played out, and we are not falling for it anymore.
I have a question for you, Kaya, kind of back to that topic of the all Black woman panel. I think for some of our listeners, it might be confusing, some of the terms that we're talking about. So I think for us, intuitively, there's a difference between, for example, a conversation like this, in which amongst ourselves, four Black artists have decided to talk about a topic or that coalition building that you're talking about, Allison, versus an external decision maker deciding this is where all the Black women are going to go and pushing us to the side. So my question for you, Kaya, and of course everyone, is like, where do you think it's useful for us to self-identify as Black artists and put, you know, that Black in capital letters? And where do you think it's like ghettoizing? Like, when do you think it's actually useful for us to like self-identify along those identity lines?
I think it's a constantly shifting negotiation, honestly. I think the thing for me is I can recognize when it feels true and when it feels supportive and like whole, when I feel whole. And when I limit myself and other artists of color and Black and Indigenous artists especially feel tokenized, you know, and I think there's really disempowering message in tokenization, which tells you, oh no, you're here. Like, you're here playing the festival. We're paying you. But we're also just gonna like send you these subtle messages that this is all we understand about what you do. And could you be a spokesperson for this? And what do you think about that? And could you talk about this? You know, I have a friend, Molly Abomswin, who's like a great bass player.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and she's Indigenous. And sometimes she's like, just book me for a gig. Like, stop trying to get me to like I can talk about this. And I do talk about land back initiatives and things like that. But like, I'm a musician, and stop trying to get me to educate you. And so I think, yeah, I really think it's a constantly shifting negotiation for so many of us. But the feeling is like we know when we're being tokenized. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a certain feeling.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting, because I think sometimes, like, when I'm having these conversations, especially now, like being in the podcast space, in the back of my mind, there's that like mostly well-meaning white person being like, but why this and not that? But why this and not that? And I'm often like trying to respond to that and like educate. And I think what a lot of people don't realize they're doing is asking for a simple answer and a simple solution. Like, well, how can I support you without it being hard? How can I be an ally without it being complicated? Like, okay, just tell me what to do and I'll do it, right? Like, that's the attitude of some of our quote unquote allies. And the tricky answer is like, you have to let us decide every single time. Like, you don't get to come up with your blanket solution that's going to work for you and be simple. You actually have to like hand over power and let us decide case by case, which is like not an easy answer.
And nothing is, I mean, and nothing is monolithic. You know, it's not the same answer for each of us. What Kaya's boundaries are may be different than what my boundaries are. What Jake's boundaries are might be different than, you know what I mean? And so it's like each of us coming, and that's life, right? That is also life for every human on the planet, is kind of integrating, deciding like who you are, what feeds your spirit, what you need to thrive, and how you receive that from the communities you choose to be a part of and the families you choose to be a part of. And do you feel safe within those families? Do you feel seen and valued for who you are within those families? Or do you feel gaslit? Do you feel that they are trying to abuse you in some way? Do you feel that, I mean, and these are negotiations that we're playing out all the time in different spheres, professionally, personally, you know, everywhere. So, I mean, life is complex. So I don't know why anyone would expect something as huge as talking about the construct of race in America or the world or music to be easy, because it's, you know, it's just not, you know, that is, you bring up something so important, Kaya, of what Molly, you know, how that made Molly feel when they want her to talk about land back, or they want her to be a representative for all of the Indigenous voices of the world, you know, and the weight of that. And there may be times when she is happy to give a speech and talk about land back, and there may be times when she is not. And she, like anyone else, that's when we get down to consent, isn't it? Like, we are learning so much about consent, I think, as a species in this time, particularly the kind of complexities that dealing with the COVID pandemic has forced upon all of us. You know, every human on the planet is having to reckon with this in some way, shape, or form. And so much of it, as I've been listening into the various sort of divisive camps and people battling about masks and whatnot, so much of it comes down to consent. You know, and what people's idea of freedom, and when their notion of freedom means that they get to harm others and they get to impose upon others, and that somehow they are not free unless they are imposing upon somebody else. And I think that that can kind of be extrapolated in a way to talking about Blackness in and Black eclecticism, which is really what we're talking about. And we've always been eclectic, right? And the tokenizing and the fetishizing has given this fake stereotypical notion of what is quote unquote Black music and what isn't, you know? And it's absurd because there are no limits upon our creativity except those that we impose upon ourselves, you know? And it's, it just to me, it's this, we want to make things, it's reductive. We want to make things simple when they're not. And we want to make them one thing when they're not, or two things. It's never binary. As far as I can tell, nothing except computer language in the entire universe and multiverse is binary. It's spectrums and degrees of complexity, degrees of nuance, you know, and everybody is so individual and beautiful. And that's what to me is exciting right now, is just that there is this sense that I have, and I could be wrong in this feeling, but that there is a kind of a critical mass tipping point to where it's going to be impossible to ever try and, even in the mainstream, put Black artists as some kind of monolithic lump into some little box ever again. I think that that time has passed. And there are going to be reactionary, you know, gasping protests from various people, and that's fine. They can protest. You know, I just
they're allowed.
They can do whatever they want. You know, that's not actually physically harming someone, I hope. But what I am excited about is diversifying these editorial spaces, these curatorial roles, you know, the vast majority still of festival. And what Kaya, and I will go back because I think, Lizzie, you're right. We're speaking in shorthand because we all know what Kaya was referring to earlier with this, the all Black kind of workshop. Many of the festivals in the roots world will have these sort of collaborative stages. And every single one that I've ever been to, actually the first time I heard a similarly offensive term, Jake, to the Afro-Americana that the journalist I'm not going to amplify tried to coin, was at the Vancouver Music Folk Festival. Kaya, you're probably familiar with that one. I don't know, Lizzie and Jake, if you've been to that one. But it was my first folk fest, and it's where I got bit by the bug of like, oh, you can do this for a living. Like, people can do this. And I was put in a workshop called Afro-Can-Americana.
No, Afro-Can-Americana. No.
That had all the Black people at the festival. Some of us were Canadian Black people. And some of us were American Black people. Had all the Black people at the festival.
No.
In one workshop with that title. And we were dying. I mean, it was the Carolina Chocolate Drops back in the day.
God.
Like their first lineup. It was in Didi Onokwulu. It was my band Po Girl, my baby band at the time. And the Sojourners, who are a beautiful gospel group from Vancouver. And we were just howling about this, you know, like, just like, I cannot believe they used that name. I cannot believe they lumped us all together on the stage. And as Kaya said, we had an amazing time, but it was also like, come on, guys, like, come on.
It's crazy to me. What's so funny is, like, right on cue, these people always show their hand.
Yes.
Show their ass, really.
Yes.
By having no taste. Like, to me, like, the offensive, like, ghettoizing of Black artists literally always goes with terrible aesthetics. Like, they never have, like, an actually cool or hip name. They never come up with, like, anything interesting artistically. It's always something, like, you can't even pronounce Afro-Can-American. Like,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Like, and of course, it's
just
and they were like
taste.
The gospel workshop, and none of us were gospel at all, except for the Sojourners. You
so
know?
Real.
So Ndidi, do you know what Ndidi did, Kaya? She sang Winter Wonderland. she's like, I don't know any gospel, but sleigh bells ring.
Amazing.
It was the most wonderful, surreal moment, and people were just dying. And she's so, I don't know if y'all know Ndidi, but she's so charismatic, and she's such a kind of a, I don't know, she has this whole other gear of performance she's fascinating. And the way she can, she will just force an audience to come with her. She just does. And it's amazing. It was a beautiful thing to watch. You would have really appreciated it.
Oh my God.
That's amazing.
But
I want to talk about something that I can't remember who touched on it just a few minutes ago, but it reminded me of something you said years ago, Jake. I've always been leery of being the tour guide to Black culture. And I feel like that's something that we've kind of been hinting at. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about your experiences with that, not only as an artist, but as someone who's like studied ethnomusicology. Like, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I think for me, it's often played out a lot like it played out for Molly, where at least up until I like won the Steve Martin prize, nobody would hire me to do music. You know, I'd show up to whatever folk camp or whatever had called me and offered me money because I needed it. And then they would not want me to teach music. And I would be there to just like talk about slavery, which like clearly needed doing. So on one hand, I'm like glad to do it. I have the skill set, whatever. But at the same time was just, I felt like what I actually brought to the table was being overlooked, right? I'm like being placed here as like a conduit for somebody else's knowledge and like a larger history that I am only a very small part of. And I think aside from like the, I don't know, it feels very minimizing on a personal level. But aside from that, I think to me, it just felt like I'm not really qualified to like explain all of this to you. Like, I've read a lot of books. I know a lot of the history about how this works, but like, I cannot tell you where jazz came from because I like was not there. I'm not there now. I can only ever have like second and third hand knowledge of how that worked. And I think I landed in a similar place to Kaya where I felt like I was being asked for like this very simple like catch-all explanation for where everything had come from and asked to unify a lot of very separate disparate narratives for the ease of an audience that wasn't really interested in doing the work required to understand where all this came from, right? Like, I read dozens of books to understand the basics of how all this stuff came into play. I still like, I am not a PhD, but there are people who are. And the idea that you could boil something so complicated and something so rich down to like, here's an hour-long workshop, now you know what Black music is, has just always been ridiculous to me. Beyond that, I think it's just, I don't know, a feeling of like, is this your thing to tour? Whether or not I should be the tour guide, why do you want to know so desperately? And some people are just curious, and other people do feel like it's important to understanding other kinds of music that they're making, and I get that. But also, I do feel a lot of the fetishism that Allison was talking about, where people are really interested in finding out what we do so that what they do seems more connected to us and like more exotic, and they don't have to feel bad about participating in this very, very white tradition in a very, very white space, and there not being any Black people around because there used to be Black people around, and that's supposed to be enough. It's a lot of layers of problematic attitudes for that one.
Yeah, it's sort of like a birth worker and advocate that I follow, Shishi Rose, was just stirring up some trouble, some good trouble on Instagram, taking photos of the Black Lives Matter flags in neighborhoods where Black people used to live. And that to me feels like roots music. Like, it's all the signifiers of Blackness without any of the human beings that could actually benefit, right? Like, I want Lizzie Jr. to benefit from this legacy of folk music, but really it's a lot of white kids benefiting from this legacy.
Well, and that's hopefully what starts to change for real, you know, this time. And again, I keep going back to this, but that goes, if I had we had a panel during the Americana Fest conference, and I was there with Andrea Williams and Caroline Randall Williams and Kashana Armstrong and Adia Victoria. And Andrea,
that's no joke of a panel.
No,
that is
it was,
no
they
joke.
Were, it was really, they, and you know, all each of those women, you know, if those of you listening in podcast world are not familiar with their work, go do some deep dives into their work. And Andrea, as a writer, journalist, primarily just was able to state so clearly and see so clearly that it's it's the changing of the guard at the gatekeeping stations that is
right.
so crucially important right now. And that's what, and I hear, Jake, what you're saying about the editors were embarrassed and it was a mistake and it was a, fine, but the editors are still all cisgender white men, heterosexual men of a certain age, you know? And so it's like, that has to change. Their hiring practices have to change. Who gets a salary has to change. You know, you can't expect to have different outcomes if you're doing the same thing and the same people are in the curatorial positions, you know, which essentially is what it is. All those gatekeeping positions, it's curating culture, you know, and that's a very, very, very influential, powerful role. And, you know, and maybe I think about this a lot, you know, maybe there need to be terms. Maybe someone is the curator for a 5-year period. And then there is, and the next person mm-hmm. comes, or there can be the overarching executive producer and they rotate those curatorial roles. I mean, I've been thinking about all of this a lot. You get these folks who have been in that position of curating culture and power for 20 plus years. And there is an inherent issue with that, I think. You know, even if it's yes. a curator I adore and I think that they're wonderful and they're open-minded and they're doing everything well, that's still, you know, $300,000 a year for a person who's used to getting that kind of money from a demographic that's always had all the money and all the power and the influence.
Yes.
Like, it has to shift at a certain point, you know? And that is the other part of the absurdity of the kind of fetishized, tokenized approach is it just impoverishes everybody, you know, because it's not charity to let us in. It enriches everything. We elevate everything, you know, and you need more than one of us because we're all entirely different and we're all going to bring something entirely different to the table. You know, Kai and I have laughed about, we're both born and raised in Montreal and we both have, both of our dads come from Grenada and we both play banjo yeah. and we're both working, you know, in kind of rootsy worlds. And the number of times that I have been called Kaya or she has been called Allison at these various, you know, folk alliance or by well-meaning people. I am not saying these people didn't mean well, but they couldn't tell us apart and look at us. You know, not to mention I'm, 20, however many years older than you are, Kaya. I'm sorry, anyway. You know,
the resemblance is
uncanny. I've been here for a while, yeah.
That's really interesting. And it kind of brings me to something that I feel really deeply. Like one of the injustices, especially in the music industry, is that we have this narrative about the starving artist and the suffering artist and how that creates great art. People also have that narrative about Black people, that all of the suffering that we've been through creates these beautiful cultural expressions. You know, double that for women, right? Double that for Black women. So I think a lot of people, even well-meaning people, people who would say they're our allies and our champions, they believe, well, you know, Allison had to go through X, Y, and Z, and that made her art that much greater. And I do think that people do believe that about us as a group, whether they believe that consciously or not. I actually think that ease creates creativity. And think of how many artists have been able to create something cool and quirky and interesting and touching based on having time to daydream, based on having access to a studio, based on having a big budget to make something completely out of the box. And that's just a freedom that's never been afforded to Black artists. It's always been reserved for the white male artist that, like, we went into the studio and got high for 6 months and we didn't have to worry about the reception. Like, I want to see what we start to make in roots music with that kind of freedom. Like, what would we make if we weren't on a tightrope? Like, I feel like culturally audiences would love to enjoy the work of, like, an Allison who doesn't have so much to prove. You know, not that you're not making the art that you want to make right now, but like, what if there were hundreds more of us because the hurdles weren't so high?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like, that's my dream, that like wacky and easy and different art were able to be created because like it just wasn't so hard to get in.
And like, we did used to kind of have that. I mean, you think back to like Motown days and like Stevie Wonder, I think specifically of how he was just like, I'm going to rent out this studio for like 3 whole years and just make all of my hits right now. Like,
yes,
it has happened before and it has produced music that we all love. And I agree with you that that narrative is super problematic. And I think it goes back to this tendency that a lot of white America has to be like, yes, all the things we did to you were terrible, but they kind of made you better, didn't they? You know, that's like, you run into that. Exactly.
It's like an abusive parent. It's that consent thing. Like, yes, I abused you, but it made you better.
Exactly.
And you didn't deserve to say no.
Exactly. And like the whole thing for me about, you know, you run into this in like various degrees of like vitriol of like racist white people who will be like, yeah, slavery was bad, but you're better off than Africans are, aren't you? Like that kind of mentality of like, this was horrible, but I created you. And I think what lacks there and what I usually find lacking when I'm talking to people about like the history of the music and of the culture is that it's not that the culture became beautiful because of the straits that it existed in. It was already beautiful and persisted in that.
Yes.
And
yes.
The idea that everything that black people specifically in the Americas have made is something that was handed to us, that either like came down from the ancestors or came in from European influences, just is, I just think there's such an endemic idea that we have never made anything original on our own, that all we have is this collection of artifacts from other people that have been handed to us, and therefore we have to be grateful for it on some level. And I do think you're right, that that's just playing out on a personal level when it comes down to the individual artists who are not receiving those opportunities, who have to work within limitations, and who have to be super creative in order to make those things work, and who have to make sure that their art appeals to a certain demographic in a certain way to keep the thing financially solvent.
Yeah, we just don't have those chances to fail that other artists have, and that's really real. It can affect everything. You know, where you tour, what kind of music you're making, what kind of collaborations you're willing to take a risk on. Like, so much of art is about being able to feel safe in taking a risk. And I just want, like, oh, I have that dream that we will have that same freedom that other artists have.
That dream will be realized. You know, it will. It's just a matter of time and consistent. You know, we are, in a sense, you're right, where we are kind of in this shock troop kind of position,
yeah.
Of, you know, and it's like those that hopefully that the point of it is to make it more, exactly, more equitable, easier access for a generation, for the generations to come. And I think about, you know, I'm the eldest of us here in this panel. I'm a mom. And so I have shifted kind of how I think about everything since becoming a mom. And I was so, you know, I fell silent for 3 years because I was overwhelmed by the enormity of the responsibility of all of it. And the fact that I was essentially stepping into the stream of ancestors, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you are, you know, physically a parent or not, like we are all stewards of this earth, of this time for the generations to come. You know, we are, whether we recognize it or not, what we do is affecting future generations. And because I could no longer not see that and not feel it, it hit me really hard. And I also have this feeling now every day of like, this is not about me. This is not even, the way I feel about it now is it's not even my time. It's my kid's time and her kid's time. And I have to do everything I can now to make it better for them, to reduce harm, to stop these cycles of intergenerational violence, trauma, bigotry, absurd stereotype, all the layers of it that I've inherited that we all navigate through. Because you're right, Lizzie, so much of, certainly my art, I make no bones about it. My art is 1,000% processing trauma. Always has been. It's how I survived. I'd be dead now, you know? So I'm here because of being able to find some kind of lifeline and solace through art, processing trauma through art. And I don't know what I believe in. I'm hopeful agnostic, but I pray with every fiber of my being that my child never has to make art for that reason. Right now, these are her first pastels. My daughter, Ida, who's 7 now.
Beautiful.
And I keep them behind me all the time just because they give me hope and they keep me focused on what I actually believe is important, which is to reduce harm. and have a sustainable planet for our for future generations of all the living species to enjoy, because we're taking so many down with us if we go, you know. And I just, I'm, every time she writes a song, every time she paints something, I feel this sense of joy that so far, knock on wood, I appear to be succeeding in that her art is an expression of her pure spirit and herself, and it's has nothing to do with any kind of heavy trauma she's needing to process right now, you know?
Hallelujah.
It's squirm, worm, eat the dirt. No worm left behind. Squirm, worm, eat the dirt. No worm left behind. She wrote that song for our worm compost, you know? Like,
that's a hit.
It brings me so much joy.
So it's a bop. It's
like, and it is a bop. Like, she wrote that when she was six. So, you know, I can't even imagine what she's going to be writing when she's 15 and 45 and 80, I hope, you know. But it's like, we are, you know, we do. But, and Jake, I hear what you're saying, this notion of that we have to prove our worth and that we, or that nothing that we do is ours, is so bizarre and ridiculous. But it's based on years of erasure, purposeful erasure, because the entire wealth of the world was robbed from the African continent. That's, you know, every, going back to feudalism, like, we haven't, we're still caught in imperialist, really destructive models of how to navigate the world. And it's, there has been so much erasure, and, you know, all of the unbelievably rich, diverse kingdoms, empires, dynasties, you know, on the African continent, languages, 124 languages and distinct ethnic groups in Cameroon alone, you know, and we have sitting presidents who call Africa a country. It's embarrassing, you know?
Yeah.
But
it again, has it's been like the no taste. There's no erasure. Taste. There's no
years of erasure. It's
sophistication. Yeah.
It's deep, 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 deep ignorance. And I hear you, Kaya, too, of like, you get exhausted and you don't want to have to be a teacher all the time, and you shouldn't have to be. You know, I'm kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum where I'm like, I will be a teacher every fucking minute of the day if it means that my kid doesn't have to go through all the same shit I did. You know, like, I'm, but again, individual choice, individual, what we need is different. We're different. We're all different, obviously. Like, this shouldn't be even a question, you know, and the notion of the insidiousness to me of this false ideology of scarcity and competition, that there is this, there's only a certain number of people that will ever want to hear a black person sing or speak. There's only a certain number of people who ever want to hear a woman or a black woman or a gay man or whatever. Like, it's nonsense, utter nonsense, you know, and but there's endless opportunities for any amount of sort of white mediocrity, you know, like, that's, there's, it's fine, there's room for all
there's
that.
A new there's there a needs new to be Tyler black every
mediocrity
day.
Too yeah yeah we yeah. need black mediocrity, we need indigenous mediocrity, we need to celebrate, we need to get to where we're celebrating mediocrity. Yeah. And then we'll know that the playing field is evening out, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it just, there is, it just, the other part is, we don't, Adia is so strong with this. She's like, you're not a position, you're not a person of authority. I don't give a shit what you think. I don't care what you say.
No.
You have no authority to say anything about any of this. And that is what I love about Adia. She's just like, yeah. Nope. I have no time for that foolery right now.
Yeah. No, even like where, when I was thinking about like, doing, you know, whether or not to have this conversation on Basic Folk, like, I thought about Adia, and I was looking at her, she had this great tweet of like, I'm not gonna address this situation, like, I'm better off, you know, baking biscuits than addressing this article in any way. And I was like, hell yeah, Adia, like, that's just not your work right now, and you get to decide. You know?
Exactly. You get to decide. And Jake chose to address it. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I was happy to share
yes.
Jake's gorgeously written, well-reasoned, well-researched piece. And, you know, I was happy to share that. And I was happy to share about Jake's record, because it's a beautiful yes. record. And I'm happy to share anything Kaya ever mm-hmm. does or you ever do, because I resonate with your art. And it feeds my spirit, and I want more people to hear it. You know, it's like, it's as simple
that's
as
what
that.
It's about.
It's what it's about. And I, and no, does every single, are we going to love every single Black person's artistic expression? Why would we? Any no. more than we would love every single anybody's expression? No. You know, we all practice our internal compass. You know, we all follow our internal compasses and we amplify and uplift the things that speak to us and move us. And I personally choose to ignore and say nothing about the things that don't move me, because I feel any need to spew forth negativity into the world myself, you know?
Wow. It's almost as though you move through the world with respect and good taste and a reasonable sense of like what you need to speak on and what you don't need to speak on. And it's almost as though some people weren't raised with that kind of internal compass. That's just something that I find funny and interesting. I want to move towards the less shady. let's talk about that future generation. So like, imagine there is a Black artist listening to this conversation right now, and they, you know, what advice would you give them? What is some wisdom? What is some strength that you could give to somebody who's maybe just getting started? Can we start with you, Jake?
Sure. I suppose my immediate advice, I mean, it would depend on how old they were or like, you know, where in their career they were. So it's hard to speak generally, but I think the thing that was most important for me is that I made connections with older musicians who were already doing this very early on. I mean, my first like, you know, fiddle camp music learning experience was with Rhiannon Giddens and Hubby Jenkins. So I had the opportunity to get to know them and talk to them about it a little bit and, like, you know, get to know things like, oh, you probably shouldn't go to Galax, and like these other things that were kind of known in the community that I didn't know and I wouldn't have been aware of. You know, additionally, I just think that there's a tendency to look out for one another. I mean, Rhiannon in particular is so generous with sharing her platform with other artists that she believes in and who she believes should be heard. And I, you know, I was one of those. She brought me on some shows. I think Kaya did too. So, and obviously Allison's like in a band with her. She's like one of my favorite bands.
It's such a fucking good band.
Seriously. Seriously.
Can I say something? You know who else was gonna be in that band, but it didn't work with her schedule? Kaya.
Oh my god.
We asked Kaya and we asked Valerie June as well. And it didn't work for either of their schedules. But there is a like
extended cut.
Yeah. There's gonna be more. We're gonna be doing more down the line and we're gonna have some special guests. That's all.
I'm relieved to know that.
The OND extended universe.
Extended universe, yeah.
I'm prepared for additional installations.
There are like white dudes who are like very threatened by our Native Daughters, and like they don't realize that you're only just getting started. Like you have not yet begun.
That's right.
The scary work you're about to do.
There are white dudes who are threatened by the picture alone. Poor Black women with banjos. There were, I mean, you go to like what I call general population, like when Smithsonian aired the documentary, it was on the Smithsonian Channel, and it's just, it goes to their YouTube, and that's very general population. And the amount of outrage just based on the picture, people that hadn't watched the documentary, cultural appropriation, they're losing their minds because those folks still think the banjo isn't African. So what are you going to do? It's like, you just keep making music.
We pray for them. We pray for them.
Bless their hearts. We pray for them. We keep making music and we ignore that noise and keep doing what we do.
And I will say, the following summer after your record came out, I was at a camp where there were four Black women taking banjo classes. And like the first thing they did was go reenact your photo. They were like, we need to go take an Our Native Daughters photo.
It makes me want to cry with joy and happiness.
I love that.
It's the new Abbey Road.
It's working. It's working. Yeah. But you know what, you guys? Here's what I'm going to say. I felt a real difference at Americana Fest this year. the yes. number of Black folks that came to my shows or panels and like mm-hmm. love-ins that I had with different Black artists I had never met before. It was just thrilling. Like Chris Matthews I had never met before, Joy Clark
oh,
I had
Chris.
Never before, all these just Roberta Lee, just these wonderful mm-hmm. artists that are showing up and having such an impact and shifting the paradigm, shifting the landscape, changing what, you know, how it's even perceived. And so, and then that chain that goes out into social media world. And then there's some other little sweet, nerdy Black kids sitting at home going, oh, I can go there. I can go there and bring my dulcimer and no one's going to make fun of me. You know, I'm going to go and do my thing that I love, you know, and it just gives me, I feel like we're in an exciting time of growth and that it's just, I feel the reason I'm so excited about coalition and finding those allies that can actually help shift the power is, you know, that is what I'm just excited about. That like we need to be in the boardrooms, we need to be on the editorial staff, we need to be everywhere that decisions are being made, and it's not gonna take anything away from anyone. It's gonna enrich the whole scene in just immeasurably and exponentially, you know. And so I think that is what is starting to happen, and it's really thrilling to me.
I also just want to say that I feel like one of the things we've talked about here is like the power that these gatekeeper folks have, whether it be the journalists or the editors or the, you know, the people on the label panels who are making decisions about who they make contracts with. And I feel like because we're talking about music and we're talking about something that revolves around individuals, it's a little bit easy to forget that like the main way people have undercut Black power movements in this country is by character assassination of the leaders, and that the journalists and the publishers and the editors in particular are in a really well-positioned place to do that. And what I reacted very strongly against in the article that shall not be named was not the invention of a new genre or whatever else. It was specifically him going after you and Amethyst, who I know yeah. for me are like, I mean, I've been an Amethyst Kia stan since like 2013. Like, I have been on this train. Yay. I love both of your work so much. And I was like, this cannot stand. And I feel like that's just a thing I feel like we need to be aware of, because so much of the music industry, I think, doesn't realize that, one, the people that they're writing about, talking about, even if they're not journalists, if they're just fans who are talking to other people, like, they're talking about real humans, not fictional characters, like, be kind. But for another thing, is that you have the potential to actually do damage to something a lot larger. And in that particular instance, I think the damage was intentional, but I don't think that it often is. And I think that's another thing people need to be aware of. Even if you're just a fan and you're in like the fan community, or if you're in some weird subset like old time music like I play, and there's just a lot of people who are really deep in it and random people have a lot of power for no reason, you can still be a gatekeeper and you can still be part of the process of cutting down the leaders to make sure that the whole cannot rise.
That is such a good point. Yeah, we need to be really, really real about what is happening when powerful white men talk about Black women a certain type of way, right? Like, it's not just about the music. It's not just about, oh, this is a person that's popular, so I'm going to cut down the popular thing. No, you're talking about a symbol of Black power, and you're talking about a human person. It's about so much more than, like, I liked this album, I didn't like this album.
No, I mean, that and I'm not going to go deeply into anything, but it was very clear that there was a kind of almost like a personal vitriol. And the fact that he chose to specifically attack our sisterhood and try and pit us against one another by, you know, elevating Rhiannon and trying to kind of put Amethyst and I down in ignorant way was laughable. You know, it was laughable. If he thought that it was going to break our sisterhood, he's gonna have to try a lot harder. We had a lot, you know, that's all I'll say about that. But yeah, it was very, very ignorant. And Jake, that makes me, that's very sweet that was what, you know, anyway, it's just, I agree. Amethyst is brilliant, 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 brilliant. And yeah, that song, I Can't Get Through Wild Turkey Without Crying, because of course, oh my God, that song is about her mother, and her mother committed suicide when Amethyst was 17 years old. And she has been navigating the fallout of that and will navigate the fallout of that the rest of her life, and that she found the courage to write about it so beautifully and iconically is just, I'm so proud of her. And I was so proud that she said yes when I invited her to come and perform at Newport, and that she chose to play that song, because I know that that is one of the most difficult songs for her to have to play. And I just, yeah, everyone go get Amethyst Kia's Wary and Strange right now.
It's, it's phenomenal.
Really, really good.
Yeah. Amethyst is the first person I interviewed for this podcast. Like, and we talked about Wary and Strange, and she was like so generous with her time and like all the kooky stuff that she was willing to talk about. Like, I was like, oh, okay, there's this whole world that's opening up right now, and like things are changing right now. Well, I want to thank all of you so much for being here. I know that a lot of us get asked to do the panel, the podcast, the conversation, and it doesn't always feel like we get space to say what we want to say and what feels necessary. So for each of you, do you have like one last thing that you wish people knew, that you wish people were talking about before we go?
Well, I mean, I guess I just wanted to add to what I would tell, you know, a young person. I'm thinking of like myself at 22. She made some questionable decisions. She did. But I love her. Yeah, I think like what Allison said about boundaries, that is such a big deal. And boundary work is like, it's all over social media and stuff, but I actually think it's really deep work, and it involves thinking about what your values are, what drains energy from you, what gives you energy, you know. And when I was young, I went through like a very similar process of, you know, Rhiannon like gave me banjo lessons, and if I hadn't seen the chocolate drops, I wouldn't be playing banjo today. So representation is a big deal, but I think also community is a very big deal, and being able to say like, you know, this booker asked me to do this thing, I feel uncomfortable about it, I don't know what to do, or you know, this thing happened to me, or also like, hey, will you be at this festival? I would love to see you, you know, things like that. Like, that's what's really kept me going, you know. And I think when at 22, not understanding that I could probably say like, I don't feel comfortable with this, or I don't want to do this. Cause I think I was like, oh, I have to accept everything that comes my way because I'm in a scarcity mindset. And because like, I'm just lucky to be in the room, this sort of thing. Like, I can't believe I'm here, you know? And I think getting out of that mindset and saying, no, they're lucky to have you in the room. If you don't feel comfortable, like, I'll just say this, like, if any artist doesn't feel comfortable, like talking to an editor or talking to somebody about like something that happened, like, I will be there. Like, you can call me, you can email me. I will be there to like be on your team if you just need some support. So yeah, like, community support is a huge thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so important for people to realize, like, even if there isn't another person in your town, you know, from your high school or whatever, like, doing this that you feel like looks like you, like, there is community. Like, I've been so surprised how many people, how many like-minded people there are that have my back, you know. Like, if you feel like this isn't the right opportunity, this is tokenizing, something doesn't feel right about this, like, I think it takes some courage and confidence and faith to know that there's another opportunity that will be right for you, and that there are people out there who will support you in the times when you have to say no.
Yeah, absolutely. And to find, you know, I think for the longest time, I didn't understand how much social media can be used as a community network when we are geographically isolated or separated. And find your people as, and again, this is just amplifying and expanding on exactly what each of you has said. Community is everything. It really is.
Yes.
Nothing that has happened for me in my career has come any other way. It has not come from gatekeepers suddenly recognizing me. Never, not once. Everything has come from other artists that I have formed community with choosing to advocate and amplify what I'm doing. You know, every single thing from, as Jake points out, Rhiannon has been a huge champion for so many of us. You know, she and I became friends kind of before her career took off. And when it did, every single door she went through, she nudged open and invited her sisters in behind. And that's also to understand, recognize that wherever you are in your career, you have a sphere of influence. You have ways to advocate for others too. And doing both of those things, because we're all both, you know, mentors and mentees. We're all advocates and people who need advocacy. Like, we're all those things at the same time. And there are so many ways that we can just continue to push back against that kind of divide and conquer nonsense that keeps us depressed and isolated and disempowered. You know, we find each other, we uplift each other. If we, one thing that you'll, I'm going to bring up my amazing sister Yola, because she is such a badass, and she is someone who says, you know what, walk through the world with that white boy entitlement. Like, that's what's going to heal it, is us walking through the world with that same amount of entitlement. And speaking to what Kaya's saying, have your boundaries, but also know when you can push someone else to be better and do better. Like, for example, Yola will say no to a festival unless there are at least three other women of color or, you know, BIPOC folks on that bill, you know? And she is getting to a point where she has clout enough to, they'll go out and they'll actually hire some other people. Brandi Carlile does the same thing, you know? Even in terms of, like, Yola, people she brought out on the road, she brought Amethyst out, and that was when you know, her greater label was thinking, you know, various it white boys to open, you know, and she was like, no, it's Amethyst or it's nobody, you know. And that was before all the stuff that had started to happen for Amethyst in the last year, you know. So it's like we lift each other up, and having those boundaries gives us longevity in this business. Because you can only, you know, you can only be imposed upon so far before it really takes, like, a physical and emotional and psychological toll. So, and finding that community, finding your people, lifting each other up, that's what is going to sustain all of us through the various hard times.
Thank you all so, so, so much. This is not the end of this conversation. I have a feeling like this is going to continue on, but I'm just so grateful that all of you were willing to engage on this topic and share so much of yourselves with our listeners here. Thank you so much to Jake Blount, Allison Russell, and Kaya Cater. I'm Lizzie Ngo. Thanks so much for listening to Basic Folk.
These dogs biting at my heels around. Awake, awake.
Thanks for listening to this special episode of Basic Folk. Find out information on Jake, Kaya, and Allison, and all the artists mentioned, in the show notes and at basicfolk.com. The best way to support everyone is to buy their music and to go to their shows when they are in your town. Thanks to Kaya Cater for letting us use her song, Rising Down. Support the podcast at basicfolk.com. You can also hear more episodes there or wherever you get podcasts. We encourage you to keep learning about marginalized people in folk music. To get you started, some resources are the Black Opry, the Country Queer Blog, and the Country Soul Songbook. I'm Lizzie Ngo. No as in no thank you. Thanks for listening. Bye.